If you don't mind, we're going to listen now to the taglines for some famous ads. See if you remember these.
Remember, only you can prevent forest fires.
Drinking and driving can kill a friendship.
The United Negro College Fund. A mind is a terrible thing to waste.
Lock your door and take a bite out of crime.
Those phrases all come to us courtesy of the Ad Council. The organization turns 70 this week, and we're going to talk about the campaigns that it has run during those 70 years with Peggy Conlon, who is president and CEO of the Ad Council. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
I think some people may have heard the phrase Ad Council and have no idea what it is. What are you guys?
We're a nonprofit organization that was founded, as you said, 70 years ago by the leaders of the advertising industry and President Roosevelt, initially to get the country through World War II with a Rosie the Riveter and buy war bonds, plant victory gardens. It worked so well that they continued it for the last seven decades. We're supported by the advertising and media industries, and it's run in donated media. We get about $1.5 billion of donated media a year to deliver those wonderful messages to the American people.
You said Rosie the Riveter. I think just about everybody has that image in their minds, and that was basically a poster campaign encouraging women to go to work when the men were off at war. Is that right?
That's right. And it was responsible for getting 2 million women into the workforce.
That's an interesting example because this is encouraging people to do something, encouraging people to change behavior. Why take that approach? Who wanted to take that approach exactly?
Well, there are many social issues that are important for our country, whether it's education, health, safety. And the Ad Council has played a very important role in getting people to do things, buckle their seatbelt, pick up litter, adopt children. There's many, many issues out there that we know public service can be very effective in moving the needle.
Who decides what issues the Ad Council gets involved in?
We are approached by many organizations, and we also approach those organizations ourselves if we see an issue that we think is really important to address. Ultimately, it's the executive committee of our board of directors that is the final body of approval.
Ever had something that was controversial?
We try very hard to stay away from issues that are political, partisan, intended to influence legislation. So, no, I have to say that everybody really shakes their head in agreement when they hear an Ad Council campaign.
Can you give me an idea of how an ad has evolved, one that you've had experience with, perhaps?
Well, I think a great example is our drunk driving prevention work that we've been doing with the Department of Transportation for over 30 years. Drunk driving started out with Friends Don't Let Friends Drive Drunk, and Friends Don't Let Friends Drive Drunk became an iconic campaign and saved hundreds of thousands of lives. But we also noticed a great increase in young people driving what they called buzzed. So the new slogan is buzz driving is drunk driving, and we're making tremendous progress with that message.
How do you measure the progress?
We measure every single campaign. We do benchmark studies in terms of awareness, and with that particular campaign, the target audience is young men like 21 to 30, and we really have watched them. If they are buzzed, they'll make other plans. They'll take a cab. They'll ask a friend to drive them home.
One other thing. As there is more and more advertising and people become more and more cynical about corporate messages, does it get a little harder? Is there a degree of resistance or of tuning out of your messages that you have to deal with?
You know, I have to say, I think one thing that the Ad Council has accomplished over the last 70 years is to become a trusted brand. And our research shows that when people see an ad that carries the Ad Council brand, there's a level of trust that they have that I don't think they will have with every other advertising that's out there. And also the messages themselves are pretty straightforward. They're not something that are intended to have a commercial purpose. And I think people let their guard down a little and are more open to those kind of messages.
Peggy Conlon of the Ad Council, congratulations on the 70 years for your organization.
Thank you so much.
Okay, so after the uproar last week, President Obama did back off requiring church-affiliated hospitals and other businesses to provide contraceptive services as part of their employee health plans. He offered a compromise. He said religious groups won't have to pay for contraception themselves. Instead, their insurance companies will. But as NPR's Jim Zaroli reports, that compromise raises questions of its own.
Here's the way the new plan is being explained. Employers that object to paying for birth control, like a Catholic hospital, will no longer have to do so. Instead, their insurer will foot the bill. White House officials like Chief of Staff Jacob Lew say insurance companies don't mind paying for contraception because it actually saves them money.
If you look at the overall cost of providing health care to a woman, the cost goes up, not down, if you take contraceptives out. This is not going to cost the insurance companies money because on the overall health care cost basis, it won't cost more.
Lew spoke Sunday on ABC's This Week. The argument that contraception services save money over time is an old one in family planning circles. Adam Sonfield of the Guttmacher Institute says it simply costs the healthcare system less money when couples plan their pregnancies.
And that means healthier pregnancies and healthier infants. It means fewer preterm births and low birth weight births. It means starting prenatal care earlier. All those things also can lead to cost savings.
Sonfield says unplanned pregnancies also mean lost work time and lower productivity for employers. The insurance industry doesn't really dispute that claim. One industry official who didn't want to be named said it's clear contraceptive services save money over time or are at least cost neutral. But he's worried about the White House compromise anyway. He says insurance companies will be forced to put out a lot of money up front without getting reimbursed, and that sets a dangerous precedent. Insurance industry consultant Robert Leshefsky says the problem is complicated by the fact that most employers and virtually all big companies self-insure. They pay their employees' health care costs out of pocket every year. The insurance company is paid just to administer the plan, and it typically passes on its costs to the employers. Only in this case, it won't be able to do that.
The problem is the insurance plan is going to have to front about $360 per person who uses the birth control pill, and the insurance company that does that will not be able to recoup any savings.
Leshefsky says this creates an almost unprecedented problem. He says federal and state governments frequently order private companies to do things like put airbags in cars, but those companies can charge more to make up the cost.
I have never seen an example of the federal government telling a company they have to provide a service, and they are not allowed to charge for it.
Leshefsky says insurance companies who administer these plans will have no choice but to try to find a way to pass on the immediate costs to their other customers, even if no one wants to admit that's happening. White House officials insist they can prevent that. They also say the fact that the compromise has been embraced by some former critics like Catholic Charities and the Catholic Health Association suggests it can succeed in the long run, even if some details still have to be worked out. Jim Zaroli, NPR News, New York.
Maybe you don't need the reminder, or maybe you'd like to forget. Either way, it is Valentine's Day, and we're going to mark the occasion with some sweet psychology. NPR's Allison Aubrey reports on how we pick chocolates and what it might say about how we pick partners.
Let's start with chocolate. If you think your likes and dislikes are set in stone, you prefer milk, dark, or maybe spiked with espresso, well, researcher Ed O'Brien, he knows your type.
We think that we do have these kind of ingrained preferences. So if I'm a dark chocolate person, I think of myself as, you know, I will always like dark chocolate more than others.
O'Brien is a PhD student in psychology at the University of Michigan. He's long suspected, though, that we're more impressionable than we realize. To test his hunch, O'Brien devised a chocolate taste test to see if he could manipulate people's preferences.
Once you're in the moment, so once you're in this taste test that we had, you can often kind of push around people's preferences. And even though I see myself as a dark chocolate person, I may pick something else when I'm actually in the moment to choose.
The moment of choice is key, and turns out it's all about how you offer the chocolate. I tried a similar taste test on some friends when they came over for book club the other night. Maureen Conley, Karen Schlaefer, Cindy Mers, Lauren Dykman, and Sue Gander knew I was up to something as I passed around little bowls of chocolate.
Is it all about the color of the wrapper?
Nope, it's not. But before I go any further, I should tell you, the chocolate tasting was set up to test a particular theory. O'Brien thinks there's something special about endings or last chances.
I think in everyday life, we do have this general expectation that, yeah, we save the best for last. And, you know, when we go to a concert, we hear the best song at the end of the show.
Or if we know that the next installment of a favorite book or series is the last, say the last Harry Potter movie, we get a little more jazzed about it.
When people are given awareness that something is about to end, they're kind of motivated to make the most of that experience.
Even if it's something as simple as a chocolate?
Do you like it?
It's yummy. Perfect balance of peanut butter.
Now, I only had 5 tasters, but O'Brien and his team had about 50, mostly students they approached on the University of Michigan campus. Each agreed to try a bunch of different kinds of Hershey Kisses, from almond to caramel to dark, and then rate their favorites.
First, we wanted to make sure that they couldn't see how many we were about to give them, because if they know there's going to be 5, then we can't really surprise them by saying it's about to end. So we had a big bag of candy that was covered from the outside, so you couldn't really see what was in it or how many were in it.
And O'Brien explains the tasters who were offered the chocolate and then told when they'd come to the last one, more often than not, said the last was the best.
The majority of people who all of a sudden ate that last chocolate chose that last chocolate as their favorite, even though we kind of randomly distributed the flavors.
And something similar happened in my living room.
So this is the very last one.
Okay. I don't get any more after this.
No, this is it.
Dark and rich.
Mine was a very small experiment, but I did find a small bias towards the last chocolate eaten.
I might eat the whole thing.
So the last was definitely your favorite.
It was definitely my favorite.
Now, this is where the romance comes in. O'Brien described to me a similar study he and his colleagues did, asking people to rate online dating profiles. He found there was a big advantage when a person's profile was introduced as the last one you'll see today.
That person all of a sudden became more attractive. They seemed more compatible with you, reaping those similar benefits as you would in the chocolate study.
So the last person you read about may be the one you decide to reach out to. Now, if Brad Pitt or fancy Belgian chocolate enter the picture, I bet the bias towards last falls apart very quickly. But all things being equal, well, it may be beneficial in love or chocolate to be judged last. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
We are counting down to the Summer Olympics, which will be held this year in London. And today we'll hear about the first ever U.S. Olympic trials in women's boxing. It was only in 2009 that the International Olympic Committee approved that sport. Now, 24 of this country's best female boxers have come to Washington State with Olympic dreams and a chance to bring their sport out of the shadows. NPR's Tom Goldman reports.
Actually, women boxed at the 1904 Summer Olympics in St. Louis. It was called a display event and wasn't one of the counting medal sports. 108 years later, it counts. They have punched their way to the Northern Quest Resort and Casino outside of Spokane. Despite its middle-of-nowhere feel, this is most definitely somewhere to the 24 boxers who qualified for the trials. All had the same goal. Many followed different paths. There's pint-sized Alex Love. She's 5'1", fights in the 112-pound flyweight division, and would probably like to get me in the ring and have me call her pint-sized again. Love grew up on a farm in Washington State and took up boxing 3 years ago to cross-train for basketball.
I have never been in a fight outside of the ring. I just never have. After I got asked that question, I was like, man, I need to get into one or something, you know?
Clarissa Shields might oblige. The 16-year-old 165-pound middleweight grew up brawling in Flint, Michigan.
I think fifth grade I had fought a boy and I slammed him and beat him up real bad.
Shields started boxing at 11 for her dad, who spent time in prison. She wanted to make him happy, let him live his boxing past through her. So far, she's the talk of the trials, a teenager who wears socks in the ring with pictures of Betty Boop on them and who staggers opponents with her fearsome punching.
Okay, yeah, I can say that I'm out there fighting for blood, yeah, but It's not literally blood. I mean, I don't be thinking kill.
I don't
Are
know.
You?
I do.
That's your job.
Yeah, that's my job.
That's Shields coach Jason Crutchfield. He's one of the men here who've embraced women's boxing, although not all were gung-ho from the start.
I didn't want to see women in this sport.
49-year-old coach Bashir Abdullah, who practices Islam, says his opposition was for religious reasons, but he also wanted to keep his job as a boxing coach with the U.S. Army, so he adapted when the World Class Athlete program took on women. He's glad he did.
Oh, it was amazing, you know, and I was like, wow. They're great athletes in this sport. They're more focused, they're coachable, they're more determined, they're more disciplined.
Round one!
In a way, these trials represent a first round, a significant first round, in the fight for women's boxing. There's still a ways to go. Christy Halbert is a longtime coach and advocate for her sport. She lobbied long and hard for getting it into the Olympics.
When we got the vote came back in August of 2009, it was a cause for celebration that we got in, but it was hard for some of us to celebrate knowing all of the boxers that would be left out.
The International Olympic Committee okayed women's boxing in three weight classifications, 112 pounds, 132, and 165. Halbert says in this country alone, about 3,000 women are registered as amateur boxers in 10 weight classes. Boxing's international governing body is lobbying the IOC to get more women into the 2016 games. For the lucky boxers here with 2012 in their crosshairs, the weeding out process doesn't end this week. The winners in the three weight divisions then have to finish in the top eight at the World Championships in China before the dream of London becomes reality. Tom Goldman, NPR News.
The actor Denzel Washington has developed a special knack for intense, morally challenged characters in films like Training Day and American Gangster. That streak continues with his latest movie, Safe House. Kenneth Turan has this review.
In a Denzel Washington movie, is any place less safe than a safe house? Is any setting more likely to be visited by chaos and destruction? I don't think so. So it's no surprise that Safe House is a take-no-prisoners action extravaganza that's heavy on bullets and brutal hand-to-hand combat. Washington plays the especially chilly Tobin Frost, a renegade CIA operative. Frost was once the best of the best, an expert manipulator of men, able to snap necks the way lesser mortals twist off beer caps.
He was one of the most brilliant CIA operatives we ever had, until he went rogue.
But while Frost is in Cape Town, South Africa, on some especially nefarious business, he runs into so much trouble he ends up in a local CIA safe house for interrogation. Naturally, Matt Weston, the man in charge, played by Ryan Reynolds, has as much hands-on experience as a toddler.
It's okay. I remember my first posting, Rio de Janeiro. House like this. Not one single visitor, but I remember rule number one. You are responsible for your house guests. I'm your house guest.
For that safe house, wouldn't you know it, is not exactly safe. Faster than you can say, heavy weapons fire. Young Weston finds himself out on the street trying to keep both himself and Frost alive. This formulaic story is given extra flair by the direction of Sweden's Daniel Espinosa. He's given Safe House an unmistakably stylish and unsettling tone, characterized by probing camera work and quick and edgy cutting. Espinosa knows just how to keep audiences off balance, wondering when they'll get a chance to catch their next breath. As a young agent desperate to prove himself to the CIA top brass, Weston struggles to keep control of the situation while Frost, master of mind games that he is, attempts to get inside the younger man's head. If only Weston can get Frost to yet another safe house, he can write his own ticket. It's a movie. Get used to it.
And the movie is Safe House. Kenneth Turan reviews movies for the Los Angeles Times and Morning Edition. This is NPR News.